And really, I became a therapist because I realized that I couldn't find one. And so I decided to become the therapist that I didn't have.
Welcome to the Honestly Adoption Podcast, a show about adoption, foster care, advocacy, and becoming the best caregiver possible. Pull up a chair. We're glad you've joined us. Here are your hosts, Mike and Kristen Berry.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Honestly Adoption Podcast. We are so glad you are here. We have a very special episode. We had the opportunity to interview Dr. Abby Hasbury. She was amazing.
Yeah.
She was. She was. Yeah. There's so much more to say.
Right. Which we say in the episode.
We do say that in the episode.
This is the intro where we tell you that the episode is coming. It is.
Yeah, everything she just said is true. And we really did. This was such a fun conversation. For me, it was fun because as I was actually driving while we were doing this recording, and the truck that I was driving was legitimately bouncing me all over the road. And so every time I went to talk, I'd have to like hold myself as best I could in my seat so I wasn't bouncing all over the place. I didn't tell you about that.
I didn't realize that. So yeah. Now I'll have to listen to the episode also and see if I can tell that you were recording from the car.
And I guess if you hear it, it sounds like I'm like crying or something like that. Like I'm getting really emotional. But I think I did okay with it. But
also there were some emotions in this episode.
There was.
So
yeah. Yeah, it was.
Just need to listen in.
I do, yeah. So, well, and you guys out there listen too. And listen, if you're brand new to the show, you're probably like, what the heck? Was this supposed to make it into the show? Yes, we were the Honestly Adoption Podcast. So we basically put all kinds of off the rails, off the cuff conversations in our show. And this is one of those conversations all of a sudden going off the rails. But the interview we did with Abby is absolutely amazing. She's going to be on in just a moment. If you are new or if you're wanting to catch up on episodes, jump over to honestlyadoption.com/podcast and let us know what you think of the show. Catch up on past episodes. We would love to hear from you. And also, I want to tell you, our good friend Jeff Noble has a live workshop kicking off this coming Sunday, just a couple of days from now, on November 6th. It is absolutely amazing. It is called the FASD Caregiver Kickstart Workshop. And here's the deal. It's completely free to sign up for this workshop. There are legit already like over 2,000 people signed up for this thing. And all you need to do to grab a spot is jump over to the show notes, click the link, put your name and your email address in, and you are in. Your spot is saved. The cool thing is that this Jeff, if you know Jeff, Jeff is one of the world leaders in teaching and training caregivers who are parenting a child with a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder how to better relate to their child and how to help their child. So that's over in the show notes. We want you guys, we can't wait for this workshop. It's going to be amazing. So you should join. You're going to get a lot of in-depth education, and Jeff only does this workshop once a year. So make sure you sign up for that. And now on with the show.
Hey, Abby, welcome to the Honestly Adoption Podcast. It's so great to have you here with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited.
So we have a mutual friend, and that's how we got connected. And I just am really excited to be talking to you virtually, face to face, because you have such a unique story. And I think that our listeners are really just going to resonate with your story. And I think they're just going to gain so much valuable insight from you. Tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I am Abby Hasbury. I am currently a marriage and family therapist, and I work specifically in Texas. And my niche is really working with transracial adoptees and birth moms and adoptive parents, kids with anxiety as well. I come to this work via education, the education world. So I had a full career as an educator, taught everything from preschool through college, and was a school principal for many years. And when I decided to take a break from that, I decided to kind of bring in my other passion, which is work with identity development, identity work, and just kind of fell into this work as a transracial adoptee and birth mom.
All right. So let's start with just the way that all of your different experiences intersect into this conversation. So we are a parenting podcast. While we'd love to be all things to all people, we're just not. And we provide resources to parents. What I love about talking with you is that we're talking about really from the perspective of so many things that parents have questions about. From the principal's perspective, you know, from the school administrator's perspective, from the adult adoptee perspective, from the transracial adoptee perspective, from the birth mom perspective. How have you found that those, you know, all of those different experiences intersect with one another?
Yeah, they intersect in kind of a way that kind of becomes a big bomb and blows up into everything that I do. I think that while I felt along the way that it was kind of, I did one thing I loved and then did something else. There was definitely a method to my madness, and ended up in this place where I have these niche expertises in all of these different areas that just come together really well, and lend well to a career that is just amazing. I meet the most incredible people and I do so much amazing work to help people navigate the crazy situations that we find ourselves in life, just as people, from being a principal and understanding kids having anxiety in school and understanding what trauma does to the brain and how that shows up in the classroom, to understanding transracial adoption and the birth mom experience. All of it has just come together in a way that has just been fascinating for me. Probably started while I was working on my PhD. I was in education, so it wasn't even supposed to be any of these things. It was supposed to be on curriculum and instruction. That's what my doctorate is in. But my dissertation ended up being a study of the experiences of Black teachers in predominantly white and affluent private schools. And so from that, I really learned a lot about racial identity development and just kind of how we become who we are and how we develop support networks and how those support networks help kind of nourish us. And that lent into my work as a teacher and understanding how kids also have to form the same identities and how often they change and how the different support groups that they have, from their parents to friends to families to sports, all of those things play such a huge role in who we become. So it just meshed into this.
So as you were researching that, I would imagine coming from the perspective of an adult transracial adoptee, growing up in a white family, that was very personal to you. How did you end up researching that subject?
So I actually, and I'll start kind of a little further back. When I went into college, I had planned to be a lawyer and went in just going to get a psychology degree and then go to law school. I just thought that for some reason those two things would be great together. I took my first African American studies class and absolutely fell in love and changed my major to African American studies and sociology. And although my father was a college professor and my mother was an English teacher, and so they were educated people, they didn't tell me that when I graduated with a degree in African American studies and sociology that I pretty much wasn't going to have a job. Okay. They didn't say, hey, you might want to rethink this. There's no career out there for that. But no, to their credit, they allowed me to really follow my passion. And what ended up happening is I learned a lot about African American studies and a lot about myself, and started kind of looking back at the fact that I had never had a Black teacher until college, in all of my years in school. And I started thinking about all of the awkward, uncomfortable situations I was in as the only Black kid in the classroom in private schools. And so after I graduated, I decided to get a master's degree in teaching and go and teach in private schools, because I wanted to be the racial mirror for kids like me that I didn't have for all of those years. And so that study developed out of my experience as a Black teacher in predominantly white and affluent private schools. I expected that, I thought the people's experiences were going to be very different than mine, because the other Black teachers weren't transracial adoptees. They were Black teachers from Black families, often from Black communities. One of the things that I found that was just kind of amazing to me and kind of blew my mind was that although these teachers were from Black families, biological Black families, most of them had gone to private schools. So they had either been bussed out of their neighborhood or had gone to a private school, or but had gone to a school that was predominantly white. And so although they all described it the same way I did, as isolating and kind of uncomfortable, it was familiar to them. So they returned to those same environments that they were used to growing up as kids to go back and teach. And I think that was probably the one thing that I was really shocked to find, is that I started calling it familiar, but not comfortable, being in that environment. And we put us all put ourselves back in that same familiar, but still not comfortable environment.
You know, I always love the interviews where I'm also furiously writing for myself. it feels like talking to the future of self, the future of one of our daughters right now. Where you are, we have a college age daughter. And I'm just seeing the beginning of her, you know, college experience and listening to you. And I just love the phrase that you said, familiar but uncomfortable. And I would say that, you know, from the parents' perspective, we at first raised our children, our transracially adopted children, in a mostly white community. It was what Mike and I knew. It's where we had a job. We sort of thought there was diversity. You know, we were like, oh, this school's better because I think it has diversity. You know, oh, my kids had a Black teacher. It's going to be fine. It sounds really embarrassingly ignorant and naive to say it out loud right now, as now my children are 19, 20, and 21. And we became aware that we had done that at around middle school when school was terrible. Our kids weren't fitting in. They weren't fitting in with the Black kids. They weren't fitting in with the white kids. And we were kind of on the outside looking in and saying, we've really messed up. We could have been the ones that made ourselves uncomfortable. Our kids shouldn't have had to do that up to this point. So I'm listening to you describe that. And I'm watching as my children now become young adults, seeing them kind of navigate different cultures and different situations. And sometimes they're putting themselves in the familiar but uncomfortable. And now we're starting to see them really branch out and take ownership, interested in finding their own identity. So I I was writing little notes to myself because I often share with my kids. I'm like, I just met somebody today that you can really resonate with. We did try to make a difference for our kids when they got into middle school. Actually, we started attending a different church. We started having just different requirements for where we went and, you know, who was in our community as a family. But at that point, we didn't know how to navigate. We didn't know we could make Black friends, but it didn't undo, you know, 12 years of our kids having mostly white peers. While I'm glad to say that we started to make that move as a family, and while I'm glad to say we're certainly more comfortable now, our kids are really having to do a lot of identity formation here, not just the identity formation that every 19, 20, and 21-year-old does, but then on top of that, trying to figure out how they navigate the whole entire world in their skin.
Yeah, I definitely had to do that as well.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So my father, I think I mentioned, was a college professor, but he was a professor that didn't want to publish. So every 3 to 5 years, when it came down to publish or perish for tenure, we would move and go to another university. So we moved a lot, which was great because I was an introvert. So that was awesome for me. No, not really. but we moved. And my mom was an English teacher at private schools. And so I'm the only one adopted in my family. I have three older siblings who are all biologically related to my parents. And so we would all move and go to the schools where my mother taught. So first to third grade, I was in Egypt. My dad taught at the University the American University in Cairo, in Egypt. And so my first kind of identity formation was as an American, as an expat. I didn't see myself as an adoptee. My mom taught at the school, so it just wasn't an issue. Everyone knew everyone. So it just wasn't part of who I am. It was really about me, like, understanding that I was an American in Egypt. there were some times there that were racially uncomfortable, but they were very small and few and far between. But we moved to Miami when I was going into fourth grade, and we went to we all went to a really prestigious private school there where people were very rich. I thought we were poor for many years because of the things that we didn't have that my friends had. And my mom taught there as well. So there was not the same, like I didn't ever have to form an adoptee identity. But at that point, I really started understanding that I was Black because I was the only Black girl in my class. At one point, there was a girl who was Haitian who came from Haiti, like the year that she started the school there. So she didn't identify as African-American. And there was a Black boy 1 year older than me, I think. And I think one other one, maybe 2 years older than me, in the school. And so I really started understanding at that point that I was Black and wanted to know more. My parents did not quite understand that. They were definitely of the colorblind kind of mindset. They believed in nurture over nature. And they thought that if they just loved me and I was part of the family, that I would not need to explore anything about being Black. But I was very, very adamant about it and really did a lot of it on my own, starting in seventh and eighth grade, going out with them, going out to the mall and meeting Black kids and just starting to get to know them. So in between eighth and ninth grade, we moved from Miami to Maryland to a suburb of Baltimore. And my parents gave me the option to go to the school where my mom was going to teach or go to the local public school. And I chose the local public school at that point because I really wanted to be around more Black kids. And so I went to the local public school where it was about 20 to 30% African-American, but because I had come from this really prestigious independent school, I was in all honors classes, all pre-AP classes as a freshman. And again, I was the only Black kid in my classes, which was my first introduction to kind of institutionalized racism because I knew that my Black friends were just as smart, if not smarter than me, but they weren't afforded the chance to be in the same classes. And so I started to develop kind of a counter Black identity against white identity because I started to see like what racism really looked like in the education system as well as in other parts of just being in Baltimore. So that was a huge part of kind of me just throwing myself into understanding my identity and really immersing myself into Black culture. From about ninth grade on, all of my friends were predominantly Black. From ninth grade on, my friends were predominantly Black. And I think it was to the dismay almost of my parents who really believed kind of this colorblind thing. And I think it was around then that they started to realize, specifically my mom started to realize that nature versus nurture was not a thing. Both of those things exist. And she made a comment to me about how she believed in nature versus nurture until I started hanging around with Black kids so much. And so like, all I heard is like, this woman just told me she thought she could love the Black off of me. And I remember having this identity crisis of my mom doesn't want me to be Black. And so I like, <"Ooh." laughs> So yeah. Hearing you talk about kind of like allowing your kids to start to see that identity means a lot because she didn't want me to do that. But something in me was just like, no, this is something I have to do.
That is, wow. I'm thinking back to some of the experiences that we've had with our kids. And one of our daughters joined the SEP team. And she had joined a dance team in the suburbs, which was all white. Or mostly white. So we would have to have the conversations with the dance instructor or coach or whatever, like my daughter will not be wearing a slicked back ponytail because that is not a hairstyle that we can do. That's off the table. So we were having those conversations. Then, you know, she went to a different school. And her younger sister was already going to that school. And so she joined the SEP team and she joined the Black Student Union. And both of those were really, really pivotal for her. I can't tell her version of the story. She would have to tell you that. But from us on the outside looking in, it was really, really important. So it made me feel choked up because I think she always she felt so insecure about who she was. And there was nothing, when you say like that, nurture over nature, I don't know that we intended to do that either, but Mike and I were like, but we love you. We love you. We love you. You're such a great kid.
You know, I don't know if, that's the thing. I think for me, it was this, it's like when you just are in the dark on something, like you just don't, something's just not clear in your mind and all of a sudden your eyes are open to it. Right. It's, you realize, wow. My thought process was just totally wrong. So it's a transformation. And I think there's a long way. Caucasian parents have a long way to go with that, right? But I'm seeing that awakening in some of the conversations we're having, which is a really good thing. And my hope is that parents are, you know, especially parents who are parenting in the suburbs or any other area that is predominantly white, that they're starting to awaken to that and realize, wow, okay, this, you know, I have been mistaken with this, or I have been clueless with this. And now it's time for me to transform. That's the hope that I have for parents, because we've been there. And fortunately, I don't know really where I'm going with this, but I just have a lot of thoughts on it. So, you know, I've been there, right? And I know how powerful it is to awaken to that and to begin to, you know, celebrate culture and celebrate identity, and not just celebrate it, but champion it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I like the way you said that too. Yeah. You know, we worked in the church for 20 years, and there was something that we always told parents as youth pastors, widen the circle. When your kids become teenagers, you are not the number one voice anymore. You're still there. You're still really, really important. But on the list of who your kids are listening to, you just moved way to the bottom. I think that some of that for our kids, for us, I felt incredibly emotional every time we would go to a step team performance, or every time, you know, we would donate snacks for the Black Student Union. My daughter did not want me to come in to donate the snacks. And I think that as we're talking about that, for us, it was asking, you know, what role do you want me to play here? You literally don't need to tell anybody that your mom is white if you don't want to right now. Mm-hmm. That is nobody's business there. I can donate the snacks and I'll bring them to the front desk. I'll stop by your car and stick them in the trunk. You can take them. But I remember a moment where for step team, they had their senior night, and we were really, and I think she was really debating whether or not she wanted us to walk her out in front of everyone. And she invited her biological family, her aunts, aunt and uncle and cousins. And we were finally like, honey, I think this is really stressing you out. Like, would you prefer it to ask your aunt to walk you out? Would that be something that's more comfortable? And in the end, she decided to have us walk her out. But just to see her supported by her biological family, to see the way the coach looked at her, to see the way her other friends were cheering her on. You know, it's that widening the circle. It was a moment of stepping back and realizing that, like, I don't even know.
I think that
she was being herself.
Yeah. I think that parents need to be okay with if their child does not want them involved with something, or doesn't want them to, you know, I don't know, like, you know, showing up, donating snacks, right? But that's it, right? We need to be okay with that. And that's something that I've walked a couple of my coaching clients through who are, you know, who have a multiracial family, is that you need to be okay if your son wants to explore and participate in his culture and the culture that he identifies with, and doesn't want you to play a central role. Be okay with that. Take a back seat. That's the best thing you can do.
I think I would push back on and say that I don't think they need to be okay with it. I think they need to agree and do it.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's fair to say you have to be okay with it, because just even I can, I understand where my mom came from when she made the comment. She felt like she was losing me to something that she could not be a part of. Mm-hmm. There was a part That's of me good. That yeah. she would never be able to understand or be a part of. And I'm sure that was really hard for her. It's not like it was just like track or swimming. Like this was a huge part of my identity that there was no way she was ever going to be a part of. And so I think more than being okay with it, I think they need to be able to kind of mourn like the separation, because this is a part of your kid that you just can't, you can't understand, you can't be, you can support and stand by and do what they need, but it's something that you just are never going to be able to be part of. And I think that's okay. It's okay to tell them that it's going to hurt and you're going to grieve that, but you have to still support your kid and stand back and let them take the lead.
Yeah, and that's good. I think
along with that, it can be really exciting when you accept that your child's culture or your child's identity, you know, as an adult or as an adoptee, we know that we've seen our kids connect with other adult adoptees, connect with other, you know, kids who have been adopted or other kids who've experienced the foster care system. It's not a conversation for us. We'll probably get the parent version later. And that's what I think keeping that door open is, but it's not my conversation to be in when they're, you know, with their mentor. I don't get to be there. I don't get to know what it's about because it literally just isn't, it isn't my thing to have. What I love about, you know, when you recognize that as a parent and when you begin to celebrate that, your kids will come back and tell you, and that is super fun also. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. For sure.
Yeah, I definitely did not do that. I definitely did not do that. There, my people ask me often, like, how close were you to your family? And I definitely feel like we were very close as a family, but I feel like they still don't really know me. My white adoptive family just, I came home and code switched. I was a different person in the house than I was and still am. I mean, I'm 51 and I still am different at home than I am when I'm with my family now, my kids and my husband. So yeah, I feel like they are absolutely there for me 100% and love and all of the things are great with my siblings, but I don't feel like they truly know me.
Wow, that's a lot. It is. I think as I'm listening in and thinking what that means for my family and for my kids, I want to know them. So I do. Oh, so that leads to, I want to say too, I'm really impressed that in ninth grade, you started to see that and that, that kind of institutionalized racism and began to do something different for yourself. I love to hear that. I'm really glad this is not on video because the one last fly is alive after the storm. We've had freezing cold temperatures in Indiana and it is like dive bombing my face while we're talking. I'm so sorry about that. I don't do this all the time. No, I'm really impressed by that. And I think that as parents too, as we, you know, listen in and kind of experience what our kids are going through from the outside, especially in those teenage years, there's a lot of trust we can extend to. It's their story. They're walking through it. They know a lot. My kids mostly wouldn't tell me things because I would go to the school and like try to fix it. So I found out later some other things that happened, you know,
definitely had that.
Well, mom, if you went one more time to the school and said, did every white girl get called in here? Yeah. For, they're
like, I you definitely know had a lot of that.
They're like, well, there were some things we didn't tell you in high school. Okay. Yeah. But, I think there's so much, you know, when you think back to those stories and as you retell a little part of that, you know, at 51 years old, you know, I kind of see the way that my younger kids are navigating the teenage years and I have to remember, take a step back. They're creating their own story and I can trust them to find their way too, and to recognize, and to be believed about the things that they're experiencing and seeing.
Yes, absolutely.
So through all of that, you noticed too, that there is a lack of, I'm jumping way ahead in your story because you actually were a principal for a while.
Yes.
And you did work in predominantly white schools. You then became a principal. You now have your PhD. Can you tell us a little bit about that from your perspective?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that we moved around a lot and I hated it. And so being the brilliant woman I am, I married an Air Force man. And so moved around a lot as an adult too. So,
what was it you said? Familiar but uncomfortable?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So I kind of took the opportunity to reinvent myself whenever we would move. And so doing something new. So worked in preschools, worked in private schools, worked as a diversity coordinator, English teacher, did all kinds of really cool things that just built who I really ended up becoming. I ended up becoming a principal, not because I wanted to be a principal, but because my daughter was going from fifth to sixth grade. And I recognized in the school system where she was that because my son had gone through the school system and had been tracked to the pre-AP classes and the AP classes. And I recognized that if you weren't tracked in middle school, then you really didn't get the opportunity to do those things. She is a child who has a lot of anxiety and did not present in class as the high-flying kid, although she absolutely could handle the work. She's definitely a kiddo who, if you put her in the highest classes, she'll get a B. And if you put her in the middle classes, she'll get a B. And if you put her in the lowest classes, she'll get a B. She'll do exactly what she needs to do so no one notices her. And so I needed her to be able to have the opportunities that she could handle. So I started looking for schools for her and found a charter school that was opening that was extremely rigorous. All kids got the same really super rigorous curriculum. And signed her up. And as I learned more and more about it, it really mirrored the schools that I went to in private schools in that you learned Latin in fifth and sixth grade and Algebra 1 in seventh grade. And it was just like the private schools that I attended, but it was a charter school. So it was very diverse. And so I decided I needed to be part of it and started saying, you guys are going to have to hire me. And so they hired me as the assistant principal the first year that it opened, and then midway through the year they decided to open a second campus and asked me to open that second campus, and so I did that. So I kind of fell into it, or forced my way into the door, I guess.
Yeah.
But I had all my plans to do academia and do research forever, and then just kind of took this detour to on this principal job, which I absolutely loved, and it fit really well in with my love of diversity and all of those things, because I was able to start from ground up and hire a staff that looked exactly like my student body, in gender, in race, in sexual preferences, in everything, male, you know, everything. I was able to say, like, if I'm hiring this guy who has a PhD in particle physics, which I did, who taught sixth and seventh grade, which was amazing physics. If I'm hiring this white man to teach physics, I'm also going to have this woman who is Indian, okay, who I actually hired from India to come and teach physics as his co-partner, so that we had minority, diversity, sexual preference, orientation, like all of those things were represented for the kids in that school. And that's some of the work that I'm most proud of.
I think that's wonderful. It's a little bit, Mike and I have, that's always our story too. We fell into this and we fell into that, because we're always looking for how can I best do what I'm doing, whether that's parenting or, and our kids attend charter schools in Indianapolis, and we drive because we decided we need to see all of it. And we're currently having that conversation in the Indianapolis public schools about how to create a more equitable environment for all students. So what we see is that our charter schools are getting the best, they're getting the diversity, they're getting the great staff. And then some of our schools are not getting that. And so that's a big conversation. Right now we just found out our son's school is closing down because they have to close some of the smaller ones in order to fund the larger ones. And that's a tough thing as a parent. I want my kid to still have it. But it's not fair for my kid to have it and other kids not to. And so we're kind of watching the community as a whole have those types of conversations. How are we creating the best possible experience so that every single child from every single home can be able to do that. So It's kind of an exciting conversation to have. It's my kids are caught in the growing pains of that right now. But I think that as a whole, it's going to be a really important thing to happen in our community for sure.
Absolutely.
Abby, I just want to say that I love just listening to the story of you becoming the principal of that new campus, and the work that you did to hire staff that represented, it represented your student body. Just to think about how that changed, how that is helping to change the world, because as those students grow into adults, they have that, they've already have that deeply ingrained in them, right? And they become adults who champion equity and champion equality and diversity. It just, that's so heartwarming to hear that. And I'm sure that you had hurdles, I could imagine, right? But it's, yeah, I just, as I'm thinking, man, you know what though? It's world changing, the work that you were doing. So just really encouraging to hear that.
Thank you. I agree. I have a friend, she was a parent at my school, and her son is, I think he's a junior at A&M right now. And she called me and said that he has this new girlfriend and she's Asian, and it's because she went to my school. That her white son, who grew up in a very affluent neighborhood, is dating this Asian girl that he probably wouldn't have dated if he grew up, if he went to his local school. That was all like 100% white. So yes.
Yeah. We have seen it is well worth it. So when we tell people, how we live as a family, we did purchase, we moved out of the suburbs. We were between, do we live in the city or do we live in the country? And we have some kids with some special needs. We have some kids who need that space. So we bought just a 4-acre farm. Not really a farm, but I mean, we have a barn and we have animals, we have 4 acres and we're surrounded by other people's farms. But it's the best of both for us. Our kids can run around. They can have as many friends over as they want. They have animals. They can chill. We actually have a lot of introverted kids. So they come home and it's just like quiet and nobody's here. But they all attend school in the city because that's also a comfortable environment. And that's, for us, a rural school was not an option. And we would not have moved here if we didn't have access to be able to send our kids to school where they could see themselves mirrored in their peers and in their educators. So that has been worth it. So whenever people are like, I'm sorry, you're in the car for 45 minutes and an hour and 15 in traffic. And I'm like, it's so great. Plus you can listen to all the audiobooks your heart desires because you can get them free on the library app. So that's an advertisement for the library app. Okay, so I'd like to switch gears a little bit because you have experienced adoption from all angles. As now an adoption-informed therapist, which is really hard to find, by the way.
Don't I know it.
That's the other thing we do. We travel to our kids' therapist and we pay for it out of pocket because when you find somebody good, it is worth taking that third job every weekend to pay for it. So yeah. I highly recommend finding a therapist. It is experienced in that trauma-informed care, but specifically with foster care and adoption. We know that we've made the mistake of trying to find therapists who really, undid a lot or invalidated a lot of our kids' experience and even our experience as a family. So you have that perspective. And you did mention that you also are a birth mom. You are in reunion and have been in reunion for a while now, since 2011, and also in reunion with your biological family. That's a lot. Can you tell us a little bit more about that experience? And I would imagine that may have led you to being a therapist. How did all of those things come to be? And what does that look like in your life right now?
Yeah. So yes, I had a child when I was, I got pregnant at 16 when I was in high school and had him at 17. that is something I'm still kind of, not, I guess not still, but newly unpacking. I believed that I had given him up and it was my choice. And now really going through kind of with actually talking to my husband about the story and just like, this is what happened. I started to realize like, wow, I really didn't have a choice. I thought I did, but I didn't. And so that's something that's kind of a new thing for me to, as I'm starting to unpack that and probably need to find a therapist to do so. My husband probably isn't the right person to do that.
Right.
But I'm recognizing now that when you're 17 years old, well, first of all, I was 7 months pregnant before anyone ever knew. So that's another thing is I really only had 2 months to make a decision. But when you're 17 years old, and your parents say, we will support you and do whatever you want to do, it's your decision to make. But we know you want to go to college, and we know next year you want to run track and go to track camp, and you want to do all of these things. So make the best decision for you. I realize now that that wasn't a choice. And so thinking about like helping birth mothers all these years later and being able to help them in therapy, kind of think through and really forgive themselves, because I really thought it was my choice. But now I'm looking back, like no one showed me a path where I could keep him. And I know that if they had, I would have. They just kept showing me, and even the counselor who I was working with through a private adoption agency, like no one said, you can do all of these things. You can be a mother and go to college and do all of these things. And so that's been something that now I'm just kind of like, wow, this is a thing that happened to me. And I want to be there for other birth moms who are going through similar things and really realizing that, like, first of all, I don't have any shame about it. I never did. I've always talked about it. So even though I always talked about it, I still never realized that even in all of these conversations until the last couple of years. But yes, I did find him by Facebook stalking the woman that I remembered who was the agency person. And then found my birth family in 2017 through DNA and more internet and Facebook stalking as well. And am in reunion. And I didn't do any therapy with any of that, going through the process, none of it. I've never found a therapist that I could connect with who really understood and who could talk about brain development and all the things that I knew that were going on with me. And every time I started to sit down and I have to explain it, and then I'm just like, never mind, you're not the person. So I never had the therapist that I want to be for other people now, but I was able to do a lot for myself. So for example, I know being an introvert, I knew when I found out that my dad had 6 children who were all older than me, all of these people wanted to know me. I knew that it was going to be really hard for me. So a friend of mine suggested that I use the Glide app and record my story and invite them all to listen to it. And then they could record questions back. And so I only had to tell my story once. And they would ask questions, but it would only be asked once because they all could see each other's questions. They could see my answers. So there are things that I did therapeutically, just kind of automatically, that now I can talk people through as they're going through a reunion. But the most important thing really is understanding the trauma of adoption and the brain work and how our brains do things that are amazing in the time of trauma, that then as you go through life many years later, they're not useful to us. And figuring out ways to heal from that. I think that that's been some of the best work that I do as a trauma-informed therapist for adoptees. And really I became a therapist because I realized that I couldn't find one. And so I decided, just like being a teacher for the kids,
right.
who I didn't, the teacher I didn't have, I decided to become the therapist that I didn't have.
Wow. I'm thinking about all the ways that as parents listening in, you just gave us a lot of insight into, just the decision that you had to make, and the need for real support, the need for real healing, whatever you decide. And I know that this has been just a big issue, in the news in our culture right now in 2022, yeah. When we're having these conversations about what does it really mean to be pro-life or pro-choice or to really support someone. And I know that we as a family have had a lot of these conversations. We get that reaction from people. How can you be pro-choice and be an adoptive parent? I am 100% thankful that my children are here. And I am also not for forcing women to do anything, whether that is, you know, something with their bodies or place a baby for adoption or whatever. And we're hearing a lot of this very like one-sided, you know, here's the solution. And what I know from my kids, I mean, as these things were coming out in the news, as decisions have been made, and here in Indiana, there's a big battle happening. Really standing back and, well, like you said, I didn't get a therapist for myself until I'd gotten a therapist for my kids and worked, you know, through all the things, you know, and I have my kids saying something like, "Mom, you seem really dysregulated. You might want to emotionally regulate yourself." I'm like, "I may need a therapist. I don't think that's the job of my 12-year-old, but, you know, kind of processing through that was, you know, incredibly triggering. And I came out publicly recently to say that I was raped as a high schooler, as a late middle schooler, between middle school and high school. And the reaction from people, some of the incredibly hateful things from people, and then trying to kind of process through how I felt about my own story, and then hearing my kids say things like, "Wait a second, you don't just give kids up for adoption. That's not the answer. We all miss our family. We all wish we could have been raised by them." It's a lot to hold. And those conversations have been really at the forefront of a lot of stuff that's going on in our home right now. You know, everything from "it would have been easier if I wasn't born" to, "well, I guess I am glad to be here, but don't people understand that it doesn't matter how much you love your parents? Mm-hmm. You want to be with your biological family." All of that's fair. All of that's really valid. And so our therapist is getting a lot of our money right now.
Yes.
But thank you for sharing some of that. I know that when I walked away from our conversation last time, just you and I talking, I thought a lot about the way that I'd been talking to my kids about a lot of things. And while it wasn't, you know, an unplanned or unexpected pregnancy, I've got kids talking about what they want to do after high school. And I've been thinking a lot about my language with them. You know, "I know you want to be a mechanic, but wouldn't it be cool? You're so smart. Wouldn't you like to be an engineer?" I don't even know why I'm saying these things. And really, after you told your story just a little bit to me the other day, I thought, okay, stop talking, Kristen, and let them tell you what they want to do. It's their life and they will find their way. So I appreciate that. You, oh gosh, I wish, you know what, we need to talk to you for like 4 hours. Not. I do want to give you a chance to talk about what you're doing right now as a therapist. I love that you said, I keep telling myself, I'm going to stop saying, "I love that you said that." Hang on. I wrote myself other words. Do you ever just get stuck on a word?
Yeah, we really love what you said. That's the thing. Like, we really do love it.
I'm always like, stop saying that, Kristen. I get
but also say it.
Phrases. Right. No, you know, you said, "I want to be the therapist that I needed or that I didn't have." Tell our listeners what you're doing now, and if they're in your area, where they can find you, because yes. I think you sound great.
So thank you. So yes, I am working in Texas, licensed marriage family therapist, associate in Texas. I am working mostly with adoptees, a lot of transracial, but mostly with adoptees, also with kids who have anxiety and couples. So I do a lot of different work. I also do coach white adoptive parents just through things. And that, so that's national. So just kind of coaching through parenting, and I love doing coaching for parents with kids who have anxiety or depression and are navigating the school system and navigating 504 plans. I don't think that there's enough information out there. I think that school, especially for parents who may have had their own anxiety, I think that school is sometimes a scary place to navigate, even as an adult. And so advocating for what kids need, and getting kids to advocate for themselves is often something that parents just need a little help understanding their rights and the things that kids that schools offer for kids who need it. And so I'm huge in just supporting and talking about the fact that kids, if you have anxiety, depression, ADHD, whatever it is that you have going on, that your child has the right to access information the way that a kiddo who does not have those things can access them. And so it's not about getting any extra or getting something they don't deserve. It's about everyone having equal access to the same thing. And some people need different things. And that's a lesson that my kids taught me. I mentioned my 20-year-old has anxiety. My 16-year-old has anxiety, depression, and OCD. And so learning to navigate that and to ask them, like, if you had a perfect day, what would happen in the environment in order for it to make it the perfect day? And so my daughter would tell me, like, this person would check on me. I would be able to walk out of the classroom to take a break when anxiety gets too much. If we're not doing direct instruction, I can listen to music and put headphones on so that I can drown things out. And so being able to have these conversations with my kids to say, like, they know what they need to navigate this, and parents just don't know that they can ask. So that was a lot to say, but yeah.
No, so your phone's going to be ringing off the hook. So I'm thinking like, yeah, where were you in that IEP meeting the other day? I really needed to.
Yes.
Seriously, this audience is hugely dedicated. So she's right. Your phone may be ringing off the hook.
Yeah, it's one of the proudest things I've done is my 16-year-old this year, the second day of school, she said, hey, can you print this thing for me? And so I printed it. She had written a letter to all of her teachers to say, this is who I am. These are the things I struggle with. This is how it might show up in your classroom. And this is how you can help me. And I was just floored by the fact that, like, all these years of helping her advocate for herself, now she at 16, she's like, I know what to do and I've got this, which really made me feel great about her going off to college in 2 years, because there were times a few years ago where I really worried about whether or not she'd be able to navigate it. So yeah, this is work that I'm really proud of.
Man, that's fantastic. I think we're going to have to revisit this at another point, because you are actually also writing a book have in the process of writing.
So I've written a memoir. I'm in the process of publishing. Yes, it's a memoir. Yes, about my life, about transracial adoption, about identity development, about surviving all kinds of trauma. So it is in the process of being published right now. It's a lot. it feels like running around naked on the freeway, kind of putting it out there, but it is what it is. And I'm going to do it because I do believe that secrets are super harmful. And I think that if we were to talk about the things that we go through more with more transparency, that we would normalize life. Like, life is messy and life is hard. And I think that we try to act like it's not and show our Instagram selves to the world. And I am really trying to say, hey, like, I've been through a lot and this is how I've dealt with it all. And I hope that you can just learn something from what I did and we can have a conversation about all of our experiences together.
Well, I think that your willingness to be vulnerable in your writing and here today, and to take that that experience, all those experiences you've had, and put them into what you do in the world, I think that this has been an incredibly valuable conversation. I think you are a treasure, and I'm just really grateful that we had a chance to talk to you today. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Honestly Adoption Podcast, a resource courtesy of the Honestly Adoption Company. To learn more about us, visit www.honestlyadoption.com.